It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at how states are handling budget surpluses and tax cuts, and what Wisconsin might be able to expect as Governor Walker gets ready to announce his spending plan for the state's billion-dollar surplus.
First, after a weekend that saw almost spring-like temperatures and melting snow, it's back to being bone-chillingly cold out there. And because of that, it can get pretty slippery, especially in places meant for walking, like sidewalks and parking lots.
And while walking safely on snow and ice sounds like something most Wisconsinites should have a handle on, falls account for more than 1 million injuries a year in the United States. And these falls can lead to other injuries and big medical bills.
To help keep us on 2 feet this winter, we called up Martin Tirado, CEO of the Snow and Ice Management Association based in Milwaukee. Martin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what do we need to know about walking on ice? It seems simple. You see some ice, you walk more carefully, you're okay, and yet people fall down and break stuff all the time. What do we need to know about being safe?
Well, yeah, some of it does seem obvious, but in a lot of ways it's like safe winter driving. You know, you see some tips on how to drive safer in winter every year. Walking is really no different. People need to just be aware of their surroundings, slow down, walk slowly and carefully, wear proper footwear, plan ahead, and, kind of be aware of where there's conditions for ice. A lot of times it forms underneath snow, so you can't see it. There's also black ice, which is very hard to see as well, too. And kind of like you mentioned at the beginning of the intro to the show, is in situations where there's some thawing and then refreezing makes it particularly treacherous.
In terms of how big a problem these winter falls are, how seriously should we take them?
Very seriously. A lot of serious accidents that happen because of them. Some of them minor, but of course, people like the elderly can be more prone to more significant injuries. We commonly cite a major insurance study that they allocate $1 billion every year to slip and fall cases. 35% of those are attributable to snow and ice, and those claims can be significant because of the injuries that do occur.
Do you have any numbers on just how many of us fall down on the ice in winter in Wisconsin?
Not of total number of people, but we do have some statistics, again, from an insurance study that a lot of times these slip and falls happen. People are aware of, like, their driveways and their properties. In a lot of cases, it's more predominantly in parking lots, parking garages, on sidewalks, in your way to when you're going to work, also at stores that you're shopping at. Those are the common places where it does happen, and oftentimes it's because you're not familiar with the area, you're not familiar where there may be some melting and refreezing. Bad drainage on parking lots is an area that could be even a significant hazard as well, too. And that's where people need to really be careful. We're pretty safe when we're, on our own properties, homes. It's when we go out and winter conditions, and they're treacherous out there.
So you mentioned footwear, and that seems like the perfect place to start. Your shoes, what do we need to be wearing on our feet to get the most traction and have the least chance of falling?
Well, look at the soles of the shoes that you're wearing and make sure that they aren't smooth, that there is proper traction on them. Boots, if you possibly can. Look for shoes where the entire part of the bottom of the shoe is touching the surface of the ground, similar to what boots provide versus other types of more formal or dressier shoes. Those are kind of the main things, is look for shoes and boots that have very good traction so that you're not slipping and sliding out there.
Now, a lot of people subscribe to wearing those. I think the one brand name that I know of is Yak Tracks. You put them on and they've got little studs on the bottom to dig into the ground. Is some sort of a contraption like that advisable?
Yeah, anything that adds more traction is great. Yeah, I'm familiar with that product. There's also several others out there that offer great traction in winter weather. I think people can find them pretty easily at retail stores or online. But, yeah, those products do work great. Anything that adds traction to when you're walking is beneficial.
Now, what about spots where ice is likely to form? You mentioned that a little bit before. Where should we be on particular lookout for ice and maybe black ice, slippery spots?
Look where there's poor drainage areas and parking lots, roofs and gutters. You see, you know, gutters and downspouts such have thawing and refreezing that can, you know, happen continuously as that moisture and, you know, water collects in those areas and then freezes. Again, one thing I mentioned is a lot of times it looks like, you know, a thin layer of snow can be offer some type of traction to sink your feet into, but underneath it, very commonly there is ice that can, then you can slip and fall on that. Those are some of the things that to look out for. We also really advise people to walk on areas that are have clearly been you know, salt's been applied, they've been shoveled. Other people are using those areas. You know, don't try to take shortcuts. You know, through, you know, trying to walk through snow banks or over them. Usually those areas are much more treacherous. Look for the well paved, you know, the surfaces that have been cleared.
Now, in terms of when we fall down, does it generally just happen when people are walking down the sidewalk, or are there particular situations, getting in and out of cars, I don't know, or doing other things that might make them more likely to fall?
Really, it can be all of that. You know, what we've seen through some of the studies we've looked at, it really is people who are just, you know, walking too fast, thinking that it's just like, you know, bare surfaces, like in the summertime. You know, you need to slow down, and people not wearing the proper footwear. Those are the main instances. It's kind of when people are out and about. It can kind of happen at random times. You know, like you mentioned, getting out of cars, in parking lots, going in and out of buildings. Be real careful when say you walk in the entrance of a building, and usually there are some mats to wipe your shoes off, but after that, the floors get very slippery because of just water that's formed inside these stores. So certainly, you know, entering and exiting buildings, because it could be a hazardous area as well.
What about handling stairs in the winter?
Well, you know, go slow. Again, look for areas where there's handrails that you can grip and hold on to those. Stairs are very common for ice and snow to build up on, and you know, very hard to keep clear of snow and ice at all times. So just, you know, walk slowly, walk evenly, and hold on to a handrail if you can.
If you're someone who is a little more vulnerable, maybe you're elderly, maybe you're recovering from an injury, is it completely over the top to wear a helmet?
No, I don't think it is. You know, you don't see it very often, but I don't think that is over the top. I think you know, anything that provides some safety for people that may be in a more fragile physical condition would be helpful. You know, there's other parts of the body, though, that you need to be aware of, too. You know, ankles and falling on and trying to catch yourself on your hands, or you can really hurt your arms or your wrists. So there's kind of all parts that you really need to be careful. And again, for elderly, we just advise even more so to be slow and go very carefully out there.
Now, I don't think I'm the only one who's already excited about spring, but there is that thaw period then when everything is kind of slushy and melty. Is there a particular time when you at the Snow and Ice Management Association kind of go, okay, the coast is clear, people, you don't have to be so careful? When do we know it's safe to just walk as normal?
Well, it's really when you see, you know, paved surfaces that are free and clear of snow. I mean, yeah, snowstorms occur, especially in this area, Wisconsin, all the way until May at times. So it's really, you have to be just kind of keep a lookout when areas are free and clear of snow and ice. You know, then it's much safer out there.
All right, Martin, thanks for all the advice and thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Martin Tirado is the CEO of the Snow and Ice Management Association based in Milwaukee.
We got news recently that the state of Wisconsin is sitting on nearly $1 billion in surplus money. And while there has been plenty of talk about how it should be spent, Governor Walker has remained quiet, at least until his State of the State speech on Wednesday, where he'll lay out his plans.
Walker has indicated that he'd like some kind of tax reform, something that's been pursued in other states with positive fiscal outlooks. But are any of these models for what Wisconsin might pursue and what challenges, if any, our state's facing after pursuing tax reform?
Joining us now is Elaine Povich. She's a staff writer for Stateline, where she covers tax and budget issues, and she's been looking at how states are dealing with surplus money. Elaine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Happy to be there.
Now, is the situation in Wisconsin unusual, or are there a lot of other states that are dealing with surpluses right now?
No, it's not unusual at all. States, for the first time since the Great Recession, have sort of climbed back out of it, and many, if not most of them, probably 40-something states, are looking at surpluses right now. It's kind of a heady feeling for these states, which have been engaged mostly in belt tightening and cutting and in some cases having to raise taxes to balance their budgets. And all of a sudden this year they're looking at surpluses. It's something they're not used to. And many of the states are trying to figure out what to do with the extra money. It's a kind of a pleasant choice to have, but it's not as easy as it might sound.
Now, why is it? Why is it not that easy?
Well, here's the thing. The states cut a lot of services, cut a lot of programs, did a lot of belt tightening during the recession. So the states have tremendous pent-up demands. Their infrastructure hasn't been fixed in 6 or 8 years. Education got cut. Healthcare got cut. And so in addition to the demand on one side to, let's say, cut taxes, there's also a demand on the other side to, you know, address some of these issues which were neglected over the past 5 or 6 years.
Now what has tended to happen in states that have had surpluses? I know that there were some that had them last year and have dealt with that. Have you seen other states cutting taxes or adding money back into programs?
Yes. California, for example, is putting some money back into education and into high-speed rail. You've got other states where, in Louisiana, for example, Governor Jindal wants to use the surplus there for education and health care. So you are seeing these states address some of these issues that, you know, have been faltering over the past 5 or 6 years.
Have there been any states that have been successful at saying, okay, we're going to cut taxes?
Oh, sure. Kansas was the most notable one last time around. And so far, a lot of the governors who have already done their State of the States, which I gather yours is coming up, a lot of them that have already done their State of the States are talking about cutting taxes. Popular one this time around is property taxes. Now, that's a state-local partnership issue, but both New York and New Jersey, Governor Cuomo just delivered his budget message today. They are both talking about cutting property taxes. They think this is hitting taxpayers hardest, even harder than income taxes. Governor Cuomo in New York suggested that most New Yorkers pay more in property taxes than they do in income taxes, and that's a big bite. In Nebraska, Governor Hyman is talking to lawmakers about approving a package of tax cuts that would reduce income and property taxes. So it's definitely coming up this year.
So how easy is it for a governor or a legislature to decide to cut taxes?
Well, tax cuts are always popular. So, you know, you would think it would be ridiculously easy. And in some cases, like in Kansas, it has been. In general, now I won't say that for every state, but red states where you have Republican governors and Republican legislatures are more likely to do significant tax cuts than blue states where there's probably a higher likelihood in general of putting this surplus into services. One of the wild cards in this whole debate is the so-called rainy day funds. One of the things that states did during the recession was really tap their rainy day funds. They looked around in the recession and said, yup, it's raining, and it is time for us to dig into those savings that we've actually accumulated for times just like this. In some states, the rainy day funds have really gotten dangerously low to non-existent. So there is competing pressure in these states to put money back into the rainy day funds because it is fresh in people's minds that, yeah, okay, we had a recession. We had to dig in. What happens if there's another recession when the next downturn comes? If we don't put money back into that rainy day fund, we're not going to have anything to tap when the next recession inevitably shows up.
Now, looking at the states, do you have any sense of what the future of surpluses looks like from the numbers that are coming out? Is there a possibility it could slow down and there may not be these big surpluses for states to deal with?
Yes. There was a bit of an anomaly in the last revenue cycle. The federal law that dealt with income taxes had a lot of taxpayers, without getting into a whole lot of detail, but a lot of taxpayers shifted their taxes into 2013. That was to avoid what they thought was going to be higher taxes in 2014. So the states got a big bump from so-called income tax shifting. That's not going to happen in the next couple of years out. So while states are not probably going to see the same significant bump that they got, the one-time bump, the economies of the states are improving. And so you can expect that their revenue stream will increase, maybe not as much as it did in 2013, but at least better than it has been over the past 5 or 6 years. And I think states are cognizant of this.
So where do you think Wisconsin fits into that picture? Do you have a sense of that?
You probably know this better than I, but the issue of the income shifting was across the country. So I would imagine that, you know, Wisconsin was in the same boat. Although I will tell you that California had the most income shifting, and that has to do with the fact that there's an awful lot of affluent people in California. First of all, there's a lot of people, period, but there's an awful lot of affluent people out there. So the larger percentage of your state population that qualifies as millionaires is probably going to influence that more than anything else.
Now, you mentioned that there are a number of states that have put money back into state programs, like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, who put money into education, I think you said.
Yes, he
try to cut taxes before he did that, or is there more of a story there?
He got his hat handed to him last year. He did try to cut taxes, and he did not succeed in getting nearly the tax cut that he wanted. There was a lot of pushback from people in Louisiana, still suffering the after effects of, you know, the Katrina and the hurricanes and all of that, and the economic downturn in that state because so many people left after the hurricane that the economies have really not recovered that much. So he got a lot of pushback. You know, as I said before, it's really hard to argue against a tax cut. Most people want one, but it's not a slam dunk because many states have needs, and as you look at the implications for universal health care with the Affordable Care Act, many states are putting money into Medicaid. Now, they don't have to do it immediately. The federal government's going to do that, but sometime down the road, they'll have to pay up a certain percentage of it, so they're looking at putting money into health care. They're looking at putting money into K-12 education, and including many states, including New York, that are going to universal pre-K. A lot of states want to start putting money into that. So it's not a slam dunk that you're going to have a tax cut. Not at all.
Now, we're also in a very political environment, and a lot of governors thinking that they may have a chance to run for president before too long. How much do you think politics is going to play into things, not only in Wisconsin, but in other states, as they think about what to do with surpluses?
Always. Always, always, always. And so, sure, the ones that are looking to run for higher office are definitely looking at impressing, you know, their party. That's why you get a lot of Republican governors looking at tax cuts, because they're looking at a constituency that is outside the borders of their state. For example, in Michigan, Rick Snyder has said that a tax cut is, quote, inevitable in light of a billion-dollar surplus. But even he is looking at putting more money into early childhood education. So it is definitely these governors are looking outside the borders of their state. But I do think their first priority is to do, you know, what is best for their state, and they have to deal with their legislatures, many of which, you know, don't have national ambitions. The folks who are serving in the legislature, at least most of them, national ambitions are somewhere down the road, and their reelection chances depend on what they do for their constituents in their state, like Wisconsin. So you do have competing pressures all over the place. It's kind of fascinating to watch from where I sit.
Well, we're going to bring some listeners in on the conversation in just a minute. So if you're listening and would like to join the conversation, maybe have suggestions on how Wisconsin should be spending its budget surplus, you can call in and join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Tax and budget surpluses are on our mind today on Central Time, and we'd like you to join the conversation. Do you favor cutting taxes, or would you like to see money reinvested in other programs or something else entirely? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. We're talking with Stateline reporter Elaine Povich about how states across the nation are dealing with budget surpluses and issues of taxes in light of the surplus that Wisconsin has. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. With Wisconsin nearing a $1 billion surplus this year, how do you think that money should be used? Do you think taxes should be cut? Do you think money should be put in other areas? You can join the conversation and also put it into a broader national perspective as well with Elaine Povich. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Elaine Povich, definitely a situation where a lot of states are dealing with this issue right now, right?
Absolutely. Many, many states across the country have a surplus. Every place from California to New York and every place in between, including, I see, obviously, your state. So it's an unusual position for a lot of governors and state legislatures to be in. They haven't been in that situation for, 6 years or so. And so it's very heady. They're looking at it in terms of being able to possibly cut taxes. Property taxes are a big one, even on estate taxes they're looking to cut. And these are great times because politicians love to give their constituents tax cuts. But on the other hand, there are many pent-up demands, and constituents are also looking at education as a place to put money, transportation, infrastructure, things that have been neglected during the so-called Great Recession. So there are competing pressures, and it will be interesting to see what your governor does and what other governors do when they're confronted with both sides of the issue.
Well, a lot of people have ideas on what can be done with the money, so let's go to the phones. You can join the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. Mike from Franklin, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. What I had to say was the Republicans and Scott Walker, they pretty much balanced our budget on the backs of our state workers and our teachers and everything. And everybody knows that recessions and, they're cyclical. They come and go. And now that we're back in the other part, I think that we should reward our teachers, especially our teachers and our state workers, and give them some of the money that was taken away from them.
Well, Mike, thanks for that call. Elaine Povich, it does sound like that's what a number of states are doing, including some states headed by Republican governors. Isn't that true?
Yes, and they are well aware of the sacrifices that state workers and educators had to make during the recession. They are well aware of what those budget cuts meant for these folks. So you look at it from a political standpoint, and you've got teachers, many who belong to organizations that do or do not support the politicians. You've got a political situation going on here, and many governors are looking, saying, wow, if we could get some of this money back to teachers, maybe I'd curry a little favor here, and this would be good for me politically. Not far from their minds, I'm sure.
Mike, thanks for that call. Let's go to the phones again. Jared from Minocqua, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Basically, what I think we should do with that money is, you know, look for the good taxpayers that have been paying taxes for, let's say, the last 5 years, not fraudulently, put it back in their pockets and get local economies back on track.
So, Jared, and do you think that would be a tax cut, or would that be a check, or what?
We could either do it in the form of a tax cut, either that or, you know, like a reimbursement type situation where, you know, you fill out some more paperwork and you get your money back and you can use that however you see fit.
Well, Jared, thanks for that call. Elaine Povich, has anybody done the deal where you write a check and send it back to people?
Not since Alaska that I'm aware of, and that had to do with oil revenue, not income taxes. But your two callers have simply outlined exactly what is going on in a complete microcosm. You've got it both ways. You've got, hey, give me a tax cut, and hey, the teachers need more money. So the two calls you just got absolutely illustrate what, you know, your state is going through and what a lot of states are going through.
Now, one of the points that Jared made, though, is that could be good for the economy. Have you seen any statistics or looked at that in the course of your reporting about whether or not the economy is benefits from tax cuts?
Well, it's a theory, okay? A lot of people tout this as a theory. The federal government tried it during the recession, remember? They gave everybody some money back, and they hoped everybody would go out and spend it. It worked a little, and it didn't work a lot. A lot of times what people did with that extra money was pay off bills, and that doesn't stimulate the economy. That just, you know, gets the credit card balance down a bit. What they were hoping, the government was hoping, is these folks would go out and go to the mall, or they'd take a trip or something, and many of them didn't do that. So I think you can argue that one both ways. It doesn't always help the economy.
1-800-642-1234 is the number. Jared, thanks for that call. Let's go to Shirley in Eau Claire. Shirley, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me. Yeah, I was going to talk to that young lady. How about get some of these veterans that are homeless and trying to find a beautiful place for them to live. You know, I hate to see veterans that are homeless. Another thing, and number two, I like to see some of these homeless children get a good meal for three times a day. You know, I think they're entitled to that, too.
Shirley, thanks for that call. Elaine Povich, you mentioned education. Are there governors that are making a decision to put more money into social programs that could help homeless vets or children?
I haven't seen anything specifically from the states about homeless veterans or children. Education obviously is for children, but in terms of social programs that would go directly to the veterans or the homeless, there's been less of an emphasis on that. I mean, one of the things that happened during the recession was that these programs were stretched, many of them, to the breaking point, and they're getting a little less pressure now as people, states do climb out of the recession and people are beginning, some of them at least, to go back to work. And it's not as dire as it was, say, 3 years ago. So perhaps those types of social programs are not getting the amount of pressure to increase that some of the others that were neglected, like, you know, infrastructure and highways are.
We're talking about state surpluses and the surplus in Wisconsin and what you think the state should do with that. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Joan from Eau Claire, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment is this. Scott Walker and his Republican legislature, with the exception of Senator Dale Schultz, have stripped Wisconsin public education of $1.6 billion in funding. With his policies, I would like that to be reimbursed back to schools. This includes K through 12 was cut, our technical college system was cut, and our UW system was cut to the tune of $1.6 billion. So there are a lot of students that have been impacted by these cuts, and more will be impacted in the future. My comment is that reimburse public education. Thank you very much.
Joan, thanks for that call. You had mentioned, actually, Elaine, that a lot of states have put money back into education. Have there been other examples of states where money in particular was taken out of education to balance the budgets and of states putting them back in?
Oh, yeah. The education cuts were among the biggest areas that took hits during the recession. And many of the governors are looking at trying to bolster up education again, particularly in that they're dealing with so-called Common Core. They have standards. They have to hire teachers in order to be able to teach the subjects that meet those standards. I think that education is probably first among equals in terms of demands on the surpluses in various states. They do want to put education first. I'd be curious to know if your caller would rather have her own tax cut or have the money back into education. I think when it starts to become personal, voters often take a second look at what they want, and I would love to have that question put to some of the folks who are advocating more money for services.
Let's go to Mike in Madison. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I would like to see the money put to some use. And in particular, Well, we already had a tax cut for one thing, but I would like to see it used as for financial incentives for people to burn fewer fossil fuels by driving less, using less fuel and electricity, drive from fossil fuels, and flying less in particular. The money that people would get for this would not only ease our transportation system, but it would also generate money for our local economies. And basically, people that pollute less would be rewarded for doing so. So that's what I'd like to see the $1 billion used for.
Thanks for that call, Mike. Elaine Povich, are any states taking money to put into projects like this that might reduce reliance on fossil fuel or promote green energy or anything like that? Or do you see states spending more money going into things where they may have had to cut back in the past?
Actually, some states are trying to incentivize people who use less fossil fuel. Virginia, for example, gives a tax credit to hybrid cars. And I don't think Virginia is the only state. If you purchase a hybrid, you can get a tax credit for it. And so they are, in that sense, trying to encourage Virginians, at least, to use less fossil fuel and more hybrid fuel. And that's a way of encouraging the kinds of green energy approaches that your caller was talking about. Interestingly, what happens is, on the one hand, the state of Virginia is encouraging people to buy hybrid cars. On the other end of that equation, if you have a hybrid car, you use less gasoline, you pay less in gasoline taxes. So it's sort of, they're taking from both ends here. They're incentivizing the use of hybrid cars, and they're losing money on the other end because the hybrids don't use as much gasoline.
Well, it shows how complicated this issue is, I guess. And I think we'll have
to...
You
can't squeeze that toothpaste tube from both ends. It's
no kidding. No kidding. Well, Elaine Povich, thank you so much for joining us. Elaine Povich is a staff writer for Stateline. It's time for Teach Me What You Know, our weekly segment where our guests teach us how to do something new. Last week, we learned how to improve our memories. This week, we're going to learn how to brew the perfect cup of coffee.
America was once known by the rest of the world for its bad-tasting coffee, but our coffee culture has really taken off during the last decade. Now, independent coffee shops with all types of coffee and brewing techniques are easy to find.
And our guest for this week's Teach Me What You Know is the director of coffee at one of Wisconsin's own independent coffee shops. George Breger works at Collectivo, formerly known as Altera, which is based in Milwaukee and has locations around the state. George, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Now, before we get started, is your title really Director of Coffee?
It is really Director of Coffee, and I'm always, you know, sort of amused when I get to tell people that.
Do you have a business card?
I do. I do have a business card, yes.
I'd love to have one of those. Now, let's talk about, as the Director of Coffee, the person who knows coffee probably better than anybody, you have to start somewhere. Do you start with the bean? Is that the first place with getting good coffee?
Yeah, I mean, if you're the consumer, you know, you can only make the coffee you make at home can only be as good as the, you know, the beans that you're purchasing. So that, you know, that's definitely the place to start.
So what are you looking for in a coffee bean?
Well, I mean, if you're at the grocery store or at your local roaster trying to make the decision, I mean, the best place to start, you know, the best place to look for sure is local coffee roasters. You know, obviously, I'm partial to our coffee and would
yes.
recommend Colectivo coffee, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, all the local roasters around Milwaukee and Madison around the state are purchasing and roasting and selling coffee that's of much higher quality than, you know, most of the more commercial stuff you can find at the grocery store.
So you say you're starting with a good bean. What do you do? Do you sniff it or do you actually brew a cup?
Well, it's a pretty complicated process, actually. I mean, at Colectivo, we receive about 1,500 or more samples of green coffees from farmers around the world throughout the year. And what we do is we actually sample roast them on a small roaster, and then we go through a process which is called cupping. And cupping is sort of the, you know, coffee industry accepted way of tasting and evaluating coffee. similar to like a wine tasting, but for coffee. So we grind up coffee and we put it in a special sized bowl and we steep it in there for a period of time, and then we sort of use a special spoon called a cupping spoon, and we sniff and we actually slurp very vigorously slurp the coffee across our palates to judge it on any number of different categories.
So you sniff and you slurp.
Yep. What and do when you get do? A bunch of people in a room doing that at one time, it's pretty entertaining.
So you're looking for certain qualities in the bean. What qualities are you looking for?
On the cupping form or the
in the cupping form, yeah.
Yeah, that we use. The categories that are on that form are flavor, aftertaste, acidity, body, sweetness, clean cup, uniformity, all kinds of things.
It's all very complicated.
It is all very complicated.
Now, medium roast, that's the only thing that I know of. You look at the coffee beans and it says like medium roast or whatever, and I don't even understand what that means. What does that mean? Is that the body or what is that?
Well, yeah, and we use these sort of complicated forms, but when it comes down to it, I mean, the consumer is trying to kind of navigate towards something that they're going to like, right? And roast is a good place to start. And when we talk about roast, I mean, you say medium roast, but when we talk about roast, we're obviously talking about the degree light or dark that we roast the coffee. And the difference,
it just means you cook them longer. Is that
right?
What
exactly. Longer and darker. So if you think of it, you compare it to, I think the easiest way to think about it is toasting bread, right? So the more you toast a piece of bread, the less it's going to taste like bread. It's a sort of original flavor, and then the more it's going to taste like burnt.
Like charcoal.
Toast, like charcoal, yeah.
Yeah.
And coffee is very similar in that if you roast coffee very light, you will retain more of the characteristics and flavors that come from the place where it's grown. And as you roast it darker and darker, those flavors are sort of diminished, and they're replaced by flavors that come from the roasting process itself.
Now, that's completely roasting. Counterintuitive to me, because I would think light roast would taste less like coffee and dark roast would be more like coffee.
Well, expressing it that way is sort of true if you think of dark roasted flavor as coffee flavor.
Ah.
But the most interesting flavors in coffee, or many of the most interesting flavors in coffee, are the ones that are, come from acidity and other, compounds that are in the bean themselves, that if you roast them too dark, you'll roast those flavors away.
So what about acidity and body? What do we need to know about those?
Well, acidity, acidity is a term that the coffee industry has struggled with because it sounds bad, right? It sounds like acid or something that's going to maybe screw up your stomach. But when we're really talking about acidity in coffee, we're talking about the flavors that come from natural organic acids that exist in those coffee beans. And those flavors are some of the most prized and most important flavors in the beans themselves. So I always tell people not to shy away from coffees that have high acidity, because even if they're not conscious of what acidity is bringing to the flavor of the coffee, it is playing a very important role in the way the coffee tastes.
And so you've got your bean, and there are all kinds of different ways to brew coffee these days. An electric brewer, you've got your French press, cold, not cold fusion, what is it called?
Cold brew, yeah.
Cold brew.
Yep.
What do you prefer? What do you advise for us?
Well, I can tell you that all those methods that you just described are valid and can make great coffee, all the way down to the electric brewer. I mean, that's probably the area where there's the most chance for error, although there are some electric brewers that make great coffee. But it comes down to preference. What I use at home personally is the kind of the manual pour-over cone, which is basically the manual version of the electric drip brewer. But all those methods are valid. The most important thing is to stick to a good water to coffee ratio and grinding fresh and using hot enough water and things like that.
So what is the ideal coffee to water ratio?
Well, the ideal coffee to water ratio, and hopefully people won't just turn the radio off when I start talking about the brewing science part here, but 60 grams per liter. And that equates to about 2 tablespoons, or you know, like a 2 tablespoon measure for every 6 ounces of water. So if you can use the brewer that you're already using at home and kind of figure out how much water you're using and then use the appropriate amount of coffee to achieve that 60 grams per liter ratio, that's a good place to start. The formula, the water to coffee formula or ratio, is really the place where you can't deviate from that too much and make good coffee.
Why not?
Because the way that the coffee... I like that you asked that question. You want to know.
I do want to know.
That's good. The water to coffee ratio, because if you use less coffee, I mean, I heard you start the segment by saying that we're known for bad coffee, or I can't remember how you said it, but a lot of that has to do with years and years of trying to use less coffee and grind it finer to get the most out of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the issue with doing that is that you end up over-extracting the coffee grounds that you put into the basket. You know, you want to use less, you want to grind fine, and then you end up over-extracting it. And the flavors that come out of coffee, when you get beyond a certain extraction percentage, are not desirable flavors. So for years and years and years, people, you know, in an effort to be, you know, thrifty, have been over-extracting, have been making over-extracted weak coffee. And on the other side of that, if you dose too much coffee in there or your formula is too strong, you'll have the opposite problem. You'll have overly strong, under-extracted coffee. So you really got to stick with the formula and then kind of adjust your grind from there until the coffee tastes good.
Okay, and so we're talking about the coffee-to-water ratio. What about the water? Does the temperature matter?
The temperature of the water is critical, you know. This is where most electric home $30 Mr. Coffee type brewers fall short. They don't really brew coffee at a hot enough temperature. You'll see in a lot of brewing manuals and things like that, you know, you want to brew coffee around 200 to 205 degrees in that range. When I make coffee at home, I just try to brew the coffee as hot as possible.
Okay, so keep it hot. We're going to leave it there. George, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. It was fun.
We've been speaking with George Breger, Director of Coffee at Colectivo Coffee. He's been teaching us how to brew the perfect cup of coffee for this week's Teach Me What You Know segment.